Okay, thank you very much, Linda, and thanks everyone for waking up early to hear this exciting presentation. I'm going to be sharing mostly information about the provitamin A breeding work that I've been doing in maize, but also I have a few slides to share some exciting advances of the bean work that Steve Beebe is doing, and a little bit of work by Hernan Ceballos and team on cassava biofortification, and just steal a couple of beautiful slides about the orange flesh sweet potato work that's also been done in the Harvest Plus project. So vitamin A deficiency affects millions of people, primarily in the dark-colored areas that you see on the map, which is largely in sub-Saharan Africa and the southern Asia subcontinent. All of us are familiar with the problems of vitamin A deficiency, primarily blindness, beginning with night blindness and eventually can lead to total blindness. But less people are aware of the impact of vitamin A deficiency on the immune system, and that a large percentage of the deaths from some of these diseases, such as measles and diarrhea and malaria, are also associated with compromised immune system due to vitamin A deficiency. Iron, I won't say as much about, but it is, in fact, the micronutrient that affects the largest number of people globally, and it is associated with maternal and perinatal mortality, as well as impaired cognitive skills. And you see this child here trying to imitate the paces by her instructor, and his inability to do some of these simple moves is symptomatic of iron deficiency. Well, of course, what we would love to see is that everybody eats this nicely well-balanced plate of foods that you see in the bottom of this slide, because the best sources of vitamin A, zinc, and iron are primarily meats and vegetables, as well as a few other items, but mostly it comes from meat and vegetables. But as we all who go to the grocery store know, these tend to be the most expensive items in the shopping cart. And if you go to a country such as Bangladesh, as illustrated in this slide, as prices of foods go up or as incomes go down, what happens is that a larger portion of the family budget is spent on staple foods. If you want to fill your belly, the most economical way to do that is with rice or with maize, and that's what many people tend to do. So the sad reality is that most people are not affording, or many people are not affording, the balanced diet that would provide these micronutrients. And this is the background to why biofortification is proposed. And biofortification is, in fact, the loading of these micronutrients, vitamin A, iron, and zinc, into the staple foods that are consumed on a daily basis, often more than once per day, by a large number of the populations of the world. It's complementary to other approaches such as supplementation and fortification, but is also a more sustainable route because it doesn't require continued purchase of supplements, for example, or continued monitoring of fortification of items such as sugar. Now, in terms of biofortification, we also must have agronomically competitive varieties in order for them to be successful. So this is what I'm going to be talking about for the rest of my presentation. The first thing that we did at CIMMYT in my program is a recurrent selection program in three open pollinated varieties, just as a proof of concept to test whether or not we can make selection gains in an applied breeding program for provitamin A concentration. And we quickly found that with three cycles of S1 recurrent selection, we made about 1 part per million gains in provitamin A per cycle. Each cycle was completed in a year. So this quickly told us that yes, it is in fact heritable and it is possible to do it, but most of our effort has in fact been concentrated on developing hybrids. So what we do, illustrated in this slide, and I think most of us, well, many of us in the room are plant breeders. We cross our best materials, in many cases drought-tolerant lines or insect-resistant lines or other germplasm in our programs, to sources of provitamin A. This quickly makes our white lines look yellow or orange. As we begin the breeding process, they segregate in the F2. We select the orange or the yellow-colored kernels. And as we continue inbreeding, we can reach a yellow or an orange inbred line. Now, our first set of work like this, we discovered that the levels of provitamin A were not as high as we liked, so we went ahead and made a second cross to a higher source of provitamin A and continued through this process of breeding to arrive at some beautiful orange-colored inbred lines with provitamin A concentrations mostly between 7 and 8 parts per million. Those go into our test crossing program, and we end up with some beautiful hybrids. Now, unfortunately, we can't see how much provitamin A they have. So the next step, and somewhere along the line, once we get to S3 or S4 lines, we have to invest in phenotyping or assessing the provitamin A concentration. And this really is a bottleneck in the whole process because the HPLC analysis is extremely expensive. If we send a sample to Wisconsin or Iowa State, it'll cost $75 or $80 per sample to do the analysis. If we do it in-house, it costs about $25, but that's a subsidized cost. And probably equally worrisome is that we can only do about 30 samples per day. So it's really a bottleneck in the breeding program. So we've been working now with UPLC, which allows us to do about 100 samples per day, but it's still a bottleneck. We looked a lot at NIR, but so far have not been successful in getting a reliable assessment. You can get total carotenoids, but you can't really get an assessment of beta carotene, or at least we haven't been able to do so. So this is a methodology area where we're certainly working to improve. The big breakthrough came within the last 3 years or so when a couple of alleles were discovered for two important enzymes in the biosynthetic pathway of provitamin A. Lycopene epsilon cyclase, which helps us to influence the flow of carotenoids through the biosynthetic pathway to go on the beta branch of the pathway. So this is actually a partial knockout or an inefficient allele for the lycopene epsilon cyclase. And secondly, we have, even more importantly, and I'll show you more information about this hydroxylase gene, which is a partial knockout as well, or a less effective allele of this enzyme, it results in greater accumulation of beta carotene, which is our preferred provitamin A. This is the one that has the most effectiveness in terms of conversion, bioconversion in our own systems to vitamin A. So we've been doing marker-assisted selection for these two alleles. And what you can see in this slide, we've validated the effect of these two alleles in various populations. And what you can see here, the favorable alleles for lycopene epsilon cyclase is allele 4, and for hydroxylase B, it's allele 1. And you can see that if you have the unfavorable one, which is what we had in most of our germplasm, the levels of provitamin A ranged from about 2 to 4.5 parts per million. By putting the favorable hydroxylase, we immediately doubled that, and in some cases tripled to, what is that, 5 to 11 parts per million. And if we have the favorable allele of both, it goes up still a bit further. So this has really revolutionized our program, and we've done a lot of breeding work to introgress or to include these two alleles into our breeding program. These are some of the advantages. Of course, marker-assisted selection is much cheaper than that $75 per sample that I mentioned to you for HPLC work. It allows us to select earlier because we can identify at genotypic level before we have grain that we can send for analysis, and it really has great potential to help us improve our efficiency. I won't go through in detail this slide. It should be available online for those of you who are interested, but there's 3 points that I generally make when I present this slide, especially to donors. If there are any donors in the audience, you can listen now. The first one is that even in the very best case, it takes about 8 years to develop a variety of maize. And that's assuming that you can do 2 seasons per year, as we can in the tropics. So that's one important point. The second important point is that through use of marker-assisted selection, we can, in fact, eliminate large percentages of the material to be phenotyped or to send to these large, expensive HPLC analyses, thereby saving a lot of money. And the third point is that we can also save a lot of money and field costs in terms of how many rows we have to plant in the field. So the marker-assisted selection really can help us to save a lot of money in the breeding program and be much more efficient. I mentioned that agronomics are important. You can see here from last year's trials, within our trial, a tersicum susceptible and next to it a resistant hybrid. In the trials last year at 7 locations in Zambia, one of them was in Zimbabwe, we identified hybrids that were competitive with the best local commercial hybrid checks and that had provitamin A concentrations of up to 8 parts per million. And these will be going into national performance trials towards variety release in the trials that will be planted next month rather this month, in Zambia. An important question that is often asked, well, will people eat this orange maize? Because in many countries, especially Zambia and southern Africa, white is the preferred form of maize. And if you look, you can see quite striking difference between the tortillas made from white or orange maize. I don't have a comparison of white, but this is a very strange looking ball of nshima or sadza for those of you who are accustomed to eating white nshima or sadza or ugali. Well, these children in an efficacy trial in Zambia had no trouble eating and consuming and enjoying this orange maize. And as we've seen in many replicated samples, adults as well very quickly adjust. And at our parties in Mexico, we've never had anybody refuse our orange tortillas, and all the parents of these children were more than happy to take the leftovers and make sure that they weren't wasted. I'll just say a couple words about iron because Owen is here to give you the full story. But the most important point, as far as I'm concerned, if you see on this graph on the left, the amount of genetic variation for iron is insufficient to reach the target, which is 60 parts per million. This bar shows you how much we've found by surveying thousands of samples. This is the current baseline at about 20 parts per million, and we would like to reach 60 to have a nutritional impact. We're probably not going to get there through conventional breeding. But one of the interesting things about iron is that the bioavailability, or the amount of iron that we can utilize as humans, is only about 5% of what we actually consume. And I think Victor Raboy is going to tell you about another approach. Owen is going to tell you about how to perhaps improve bioavailability. To improve that 5%, maybe take it to 10%. If we take it to 10% bioavailability, we have the amount that we need to put in, and that we could achieve. So it's very exciting, that the prospect of being able to use marker-assisted selection for bioavailability. I think I'll skip this slide because Owen is going to tell you more about it, but certainly we have seen that the heritability for bioavailability is similar to that for iron concentration itself, but really bioavailability, as I just mentioned, would be a really exciting opportunity. And you may recall that iron is the micronutrient deficiency that affects the largest number of people globally. Now a few words about beans and then cassava. Steve Beebe at SIAT has been working on improving the iron concentration in beans, and he's been doing this using gene bank accessions as the one you see here. And the biggest problem with using these gene bank accessions is its lack, or their lack of adaptation to the tropical hot climates. And you can see perhaps in the hand here shrunken bean kernels, which are not attractive for the market, and also premature drying of some of the plants. So they have to be used in combinations with other things. And one of the projects that he's been working on is use of some of the interspecific crosses with other types of beans with quite some success. He's had to make double crosses where he uses high iron on one side of the cross and drought-tolerant elite lines on the other. And one of his conclusions is that if he can have three of the four parents with high iron, he has a much greater success rate. As you can see in this figure on the left bar, he had two of the four parents with high iron. The mean of the segregants was 70 parts per million, but with three of them, the mean was 75. And here's his target selections, the recurrent parent with about 50 part per million, and the improved ones with 75 to 90 parts per million of iron. So these are some beautiful pictures of some of the beans with high irons, high iron concentration, 40 to 80% improvement over the common or current varieties. In terms of cassava, there's really one really cool outcome or result that I want to share with you. But before that, I'll just show you the slide from Hernan Ceballos demonstrating consistent gains in terms of the beta-carotene content in cassava. One of the interesting things in cassava is that almost all of the yellow color or the carotenoid is in fact beta-carotene, which is useful for making provitamin A. That's not the case in maize. In maize, the correlation between color and provitamin A is very small, about 0.2. So just looking at color doesn't get you to provitamin A in maize, but it does in cassava. So they've invested a lot of effort into developing colorimeter assays for rapid assay and fairly high correlation between color and beta-carotene concentrations. is allowing a rapid screening method. You realize, I told you in maize, the HPLC is a big bottleneck. Well, they don't have to use HPLC for all of their breeding materials in cassava. But here's the cool result, which they just found because they were lazy and they took a long time to analyze some of their samples. And so what they discovered after waiting 4 months, oops, we should have analyzed this right away, but no, wait a minute. Some of these things that we left for a long time actually look pretty good. And in cassava, one of the biggest problems is rapid deterioration of cassava roots after harvesting. But the beta carotene, and they hypothesize it's because of their antioxidant activities, a lot of the high beta carotene cassavas do not show this post-harvest physiological deterioration that cassava normally shows. So here's a tremendous plus, unexpected plus, that is going to really be beneficial to consumers who adopt and will probably help increase adoption of orange cassava. And now the easy success in Harvest Plus was sweet potato. Sweet potatoes in sub-Saharan Africa primarily are white, what most consumers eat. But these orange guys, they have up to 160 parts per million of beta carotene. In maize, we're talking about reaching 15. So this is 160 parts per million. This is a tremendous opportunity to impact on the provitamin A or vitamin A status of consumers. You can see down here, 155 parts per million in this variety. So immediately they went to efficacy trials with children in South Africa, and these children are happily eating orange or white sweet potato in this study. And the outcome of that study was that vitamin A status was improved in children who consumed the orange flesh sweet potatoes, and that the orange flesh sweet potato, even consumed in fairly small amounts, because this isn't a staple food. It's a vegetable that people eat either as a snack or as part of a meal. But even relatively small amounts can have an impact on vitamin A status of children. So next step, well, convincing people to eat orange when they're used to eating white. And we're going to have to do this for maize. We're going to have to do it for other cassavas as well. And you can see a tremendous effort was devoted in, this is in Mozambique primarily, including my favorite approach to have local drama groups talking about the benefits of orange flesh sweet potato, and posters informing mothers that this is the best way to improve the health of your children, to offer them orange flesh sweet potatoes. And if you can convince the mother, who is the one who prepares the food, that this is in fact better for your kids, then that's the way to really get people interested in consuming. And of course, it doesn't hurt to have orange trucks driving around town and telling you about how delicious and nutritious orange flesh sweet potatoes really are. So this is all part of the system, and we have seen in maize that in fact most of the initial reluctance to consume orange maize can be overcome with a little bit of information and given the opportunity for trying these products. I guess I'm really excited because I'm expecting Linda to stand up any second now, but it seems like I've made it through my presentation without incurring the wrath of Linda Pollack. So in summary, to me this is a really exciting project because it really opens my eyes as a plant breeder to other disciplines and the importance of other disciplines. I think most of us plant breeders never really think about nutrition that much. Never really think about health outcomes of what we're doing. And this project has really been an opportunity to learn a lot about things like bioavailability and what influences bioavailability, and to learn about the potential that we have as plant breeders, not only to feed the world, but to reach a better definition of food security, which is actually not only enough food to alleviate hunger, but to allow for a healthy and happy lifestyle for the consumers. So some of the things that we do is plant breeding and agronomy. Molecular biology has been a critical point, as I mentioned in the maize work. A lot of biochemistry in the laboratory is essential to this work. Food technology, we've done an awful lot of work seeing retention levels. As you process that orange maize into sadza or enshima, this food that's being consumed by this happy gentleman, how much is lost through the process of cooking the material? What happens in nutrition, the bioavailability? Well, we can put all the iron we want into that maize, but if only 5% is useful, we're not going to have a huge impact. Acceptance and socioeconomics, education, and finally, the outcome that we're looking for and that we hope will come soon is healthy and nutritious families. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention and hope there's time for some questions.
Kevin, nice presentation, nice overview of the whole biofortification concept. Two questions. The stability of the beta carotene in either the maize or the cassava, how much loss with time are we getting there?
Mm-hmm. Just summarize that.
Okay, the question is about retention of the provitamins A in the crops after harvest and over time, how much is lost. In maize, we've looked at this to some extent, and what we've seen is that in the first 4 weeks, you have the greatest amount of loss. And it can go, and we can lose as much as a third or even a half of what's there. And a lot depends on storage conditions. Heat seems to be the most. If you store it in a very hot environment, you're going to lose the most. After the first 4 weeks or so, losses are fairly slow. Also depends a little bit on the conditions. If you mill it into flour or if you keep it as seed, well, milling it to flour is worse than keeping it as seed. But overall, it's a matter of time. In cassava, I'm not as familiar, so I can't answer that question very well. My understanding is that you do also have serious losses, particularly after processing the cassava, but I don't have a good answer for that one. Yes, Les.
What you've done, the marker-assisted transfer within maize, how can you rely on grain color at that point? Or are you bringing on other pigments at the same time that mask that and you still have to continue to test?
No, grain color really doesn't help us at all. Grain color is something we want because we think that we can promote orange maize more easily than we can promote yellow. It's a visual marker that will make it easily identifiable to consumers. But in terms of selecting for provitamin A, the best example I can give you is that probably the highest provitamin A materials we had to our knowledge until very recently were in fact some very pale yellow materials developed or identified by Torbert and his group at Illinois, the cross of Delaware Experimental 3 and CI7. Had very high levels, but it's actually a quite pale yellow hybrid. So color has very little association with provitamin A.
Well, what will that do then in terms of retention if you're in an environment where you've got outcrossing with other varieties and so forth? Do you have the same issue as with QPM maize then to maintain it?
Yeah, the question is whether outcrossing in farmers' fields will be a problem in terms of losing the provitamin A concentrations. There will be a dilution effect principally in the second crop. If farmers are saving that seed and planting it again, there will be some segregation for kernels that will have lesser quantities. Fortunately, if we have these alleles, these favorable alleles, even in the heterozygous form, they give a fairly big bang in terms of the amount of provitamin A. But there will be some loss through contamination. It's not as problematic as with QPM because it's not a recessive trait. And also, yellow being dominant, farmers can select the yellow kernels, as I showed in my first screens of the breeding process or slides of the breeding process.
1 minute for a question.
How does it compare to the golden rice in terms of content?
The golden rice contents, at least the second generation golden rice, are higher. I don't remember the exact values, but it's 30 or more parts per million, as I recall. So those are quite a bit higher. And there are, in fact, transgenic events for vitamin A in maize as well. And they do get you to much higher levels than the conventional breeding. But they raise other issues of acceptance and IP and compliance with various regulations. So we think that probably the conventional breeding will be the fastest way to get nutritionally significant levels of provitamin A into varieties in the hands of farmers and consumers.
Do they all have the same problems with degradation and storage and so forth? The transgenic rice?
Yeah, whether the transgenics have the same problems with degradation, I would certainly assume that it would be the same, but I don't have knowledge of data that show that. Yeah. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.